Thank you, and have a great time. My name is Brian Goulding. I have the good fortune of having been born a number of years ago. And my father was a gentleman by the name of Ray Goulding, half of the Bob and Ray phenomenon, what I would call it. We are here, family and friends, to talk a little bit about them. We won't talk about you. That's certainly our idea. Who's here? I know you're dying to know. My son, Ryan. A gentleman named Keith Overman, who is actually the only person whose DNA can be traced to Bob and Ray both. My sister, Melissa. Her daughter, Rebecca. Sir, who, with my father, made me possible. Was a great movie. My sister, Rory. My wife, Regina. And my cousin, Karen. So, we're here. Thank you very much. We were raised in an environment where it was a fun world to be raised. And I want to give you may know a lot about Bob and Ray, and I'll just throw some little tidbits out there. These are two guys who were in the Army. They come home from being in the Army in the Civil War, and they're both in a Boston radio station called WACH. I think it's 1946, Mom, Dad. Okay. So 1946, Bob Elliott has a radio program. My dad is the guy who comes in hour, I think it was in the morning. I wasn't alive yet. I believe these stories, but he told these stories. Anyway, because they have this magical sort of chemistry, things morph into bigger things. And whoever ran the studio or whatever the person called who received this chemistry and asked these two guys to put together a radio show before Red Sox games. And this is the sort of a joke that if the word was matinov as opposed to matinee, they would be called Bob. But since it was called the word was matinee, they had a program called Matinee with Bob and Ray, which featured the Red Sox games and a whole bunch of fun things followed there. In 1951, I think, again, I got a mom, right? Is that anything in New York? Okay, they come to New York and are on NBC? Okay. For the morning program on NBC. And working with them is my Aunt Ann, right? And these guys go on to have a career that, again, I knew nothing about for many years into their career, and just a little side note for myself, most of what my dad did for a living was something that I didn't really know exactly. And I remember each year we'd have to fill out in school some dorky form with parents, what do they do, and every year I'd say, Mom, what do I write? I'm sure if you found my file, there's no way the same year, each year for the same thing, producer, actor, I don't even I learned a lot about what they did professionally from Ben. I had a social studies teacher who was a Bob and Ray fan. He said, hey, that was great. But, you know, your father doing something. I really? No. My dad got up, went to work, and came home and didn't really talk about his job. It's kind of a hilarious thing because lots of people watch him work. But anyway, our purpose of being here is to honor these two wonderful men and all they brought to us. I think one of the fascinating things about Bob and Ray is that, and this is like a Ripley's Believe It or Not thing, that I don't think any two men, and this is what makes it unique, have given birth to so many people. I think hundreds of people. How many characters have given imagine? So anyway, we just wanted to sort of give you, here we are, Bob and Ray, they're wonderful people. I want to play some stuff. I'm going to start with something that, like last will tell me what it is. This is just a little tiny bit that relates to Mr. No, actually, I'm going to start with something. It's called, I think their name, let me just say it. It's there. Bob and Ray.
Yes, Mary Bat Bailey's Noble Wife. The story of America's favorite family of the good life and their fight for security and happiness against the unseen heart of Broadway. Yesterday, as Greg Marlowe prepared to shoot the first scene for Mary and Harry's TV special on Africa, three shots rang out, and bullets narrowly missed our friends. Now, moments later, at the backstage base camp in the Transvaal, Greg calls out,
Ma, who did that?
Miss Marlowe?
Yes.
It's me. Oh, but look, what are you doing?
I'm preparing so I have time to shoot that springbok for your dinner.
Flintlock. Flintlock. Flintlock, you get it? Flintlock, all forward, isn't it?
Well, you don't understand this. Flintlock is that animal in Jerry's Olympics. That's very sad. He ran behind you and excuse me.
You hit me, you hit my shot, you put one through his hand.
Yeah, we all always got a pencil on our hands.
Don't you have a pocket-stick poppy chair when you use your rifle?
Oh, most certainly, Mr. Marlowe, and I can only express my sincere apologies for having the bullets go where they did.
Did you get the flintlock?
No, I didn't. So I've got to continue hunting, but I'll wait until you finish the opening scene if you want to shoot it again.
Boy, that's
good. Okay, let's try that scene again.
Oh, well, then put that rifle up.
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much.
Let's brush all this dust off. Hit the ground, those shots rang out.
So you still wear that hat with the hole in it? Did you know?
No.
Let's everybody take off hats.
Don't need a hat on.
And no dark glasses here.
All right. Harry, are you some clothes now?
Well, yes. I'm wondering what a spring box is. There's a little snapshot, if you will, of the Mary Back days. Something I wanted to play. I love Mr. Science. I don't know if you guys heard Mr. Science, but to me, as a kid, this was connected to me because it was just filled with all the stuff that Bob Ray is to me, and that is absurdity, ridiculousness, and because there's a kid, maybe that's why I found that to be perfect, but I gotta make this. I'm on.
We invite you to spend another educational session. The idol of the nation's youngsters, Mr. Science. As we look in on the modern, well-equipped laboratory today, we see that little Jimmy Schwab is just arriving to watch the science perform his latest fascinating experiment.
Well, Jimmy, I see you're right on time to watch me perform my latest fascinating experiment.
Oh, I'm never late since you taught me that scientific way to use the clock, Mr. Science. What fascinating experiments do I get to behold today?
Well, today, Jimmy, we're going to use our laboratory equipment to prove that even the air around us has weight and substance.
Gosh, all hemlock, Mr. Science. That's hard to believe. I have air pushing down on the top of my head most of the time, and I don't feel the same.
Well, that's because we're all accustomed to the pressure, Jimmy. But we're actually going to see scientific evidence of how much the air weighs.
Jiminy, check it, Mr. Science. How can I see the weight of the air when I can't even see the air?
Well, I know it sounds like an impossible marvel, Jimmy. Once we perform today's experiment, you'll see what you always thought was invisible. Now, to prove that the air has weight, I'm going to use this laboratory equipment to drop a feather and a ball bearing from an equal height.
Gee, well, that is, Mr. Science. What's that piece of laboratory equipment you're preparing to employ by climbing up on?
This is called a stepladder, Jimmy.
Oh, suffering catfish. Well, I tell a gang at school I've seen one of those.
Well, I know this is the thrill of a lifetime for you, lad, but just try to contain yourself, because the best part is yet to come. Now, I'm going to climb up our stepladder with the feather and the ball bearing.
Great clouds of wagon dust. This may be more excitement than my youthful system can tolerate.
Oh, no, I'm sure you'll be fine, Jimmy. Now, just observe what happens when I drop the ball bearing to the floor of the laboratory from a height of approximately 10 feet.
Jesus, creepers, Mr. Science. It just dropped straight down. The air it passed through had no weight or substance whatsoever.
Uh-huh. I know it did look that way, but only because the ball bearing is very small in proportion to its weight. Now watch what the feather does when I release it from exactly the same height.
Well, holy mad, Mr. Science. It's almost floating in the air and hardly coming down at all.
That's right, Jimmy. Because the weight and substance of the air is holding it up. You see, if air really consisted of nothing as the way it appears, then all objects would drop through it at the same speed.
Holy Moses. Such a wonder to behold. I'm going to see if the weight of the air will keep this box falling when I hold it over my head and drop.
No, don't drop that box, Jimmy. It's highly volatile.
No, it's not. It's just cardboard. It won't even break, even if it does drop like a ball.
Well, that's beside the point, though.
Don't worry. I'll just hold it this high, and then let's go to see if what. This session of Mr. Science was brought to you as a public service paid for by the Philanthropic Council to make things nicer. Today's broadcast was the last in our current series.
I don't want to agree with you. Did you ever hear the one in which they played the sound effect out with the whole business? First off, Mr. Science is very 10 to 20 years stretch. In other words, practicing without several licenses in which all of a sudden explosion went off, and they must have been in an effect place for 2.5 minutes. So it was, you know, okay, the standard way it ends. And poor Jimmy has destroyed the laboratory and the surrounding neighborhood. And this was a mission that then turned into an atomic blast. And sitting at home, prepared for the usual, and now it starts to laugh uncontrollably. And it still goes, and it goes, and it goes, and it goes. And I think it was right to where I think they maybe he's on time to write out into the news he had to follow this. And that was, as a listener, that was always my, the reason I almost didn't go into broadcasting was the idea that someday I'd follow something this funny on the air and be on the air. I just want to get that out of the system.
You know, the way that the sound existed, and for, I don't know if you guys are all radio buffs and you know radio, these things, these cartridges, I don't even know if they make the machines that play this anymore, but when we were kids, well, remember, when we would be able to go to my dad's office, we would sit in the place where the engineer sits, and there were just towers of these things. And we would just play them and just burst out laughing. Person falling downstairs, you know, a punch, a breaking glass, explosion, women screaming. I have women scream. That was my mom, right, Mom? It was when they opened my report card, and then they recorded it. It was really great stuff. Dan, do you feel like sharing a little story from your early days of working with Bob and Ray?
I've heard something before that. Was a kid, listening to WHDH, and they had a sponsor, I think it was Six Little Sailors or something that, downstairs. We did a good 10 minutes of going down. And I was all alone in the house, and I was hysterical, and someone knocked on the door and thought I was crazy. Because I'm all by myself,
huh?
That was before I was working with them.
Yeah. One little, this will just be tangents bouncing around. So I remember my dad told me the story of, I think he was in Grand Central or some public place, and a person comes up to him, really emotional, and says, "You're Bob Elliott. You are Bob Elliott." My father says, "I'm terribly sorry." No, I'm not. He never said he was Ray Goulding. And the guy was close. He just said, no, I'm not. I'm sorry, you're mistaken. And he never clued in the guy. So if you're here, sorry about that. This is Mrs. Goulding, Ray's wife.
When he was in the Army, we were down at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and he used to go in and moonlight on Sunday at the radio station, and he had to read this therapy poetry, and I always felt that's where Charles the Poet came from, because he was finishing and slick off. Well, one time he didn't slick off quite in time as he was slicing the change himself, and he was in the back after that.
Oh, that was last night? So at Louisville, right? I read about that somewhere. When you have this passion that I'm a person who, you know, I have the misfortune in some ways of just being a person who goes to work and has a real job. And while I have fun at work, my work is not about having fun. And what I envy so much and still one day hope will happen is my father, this is how he describes his job, and I think he did too. He would go to work and his job was make your best friend laugh. And that's what they did. So much of the Bob and Ray stuff that has become sort of chronicled and maybe official sounding was just two guys winging it. And I mean winging it. And they were on such a wavelength that there was something magical going on. There's no way, there's whatever spiritual beliefs you may have, there's something else going on. If these two people can be in the same place at the same time in 1946, that is not what a coincidence. There's something else happening, because they really are these two magically melded people who did their thing, had an amazingly riotous time. If you listen to this stuff, you can hear each one giggling now and then because they're getting complete sideswipe from the other guy. And it's just wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. So Ann came, they moved to New York in 1951, right?
Yep. And they went in,
were you already here?
And I went down in August.
Okay, so you came down in August.
Yeah, and I had a ball. I went down, I was answering two emails.
Yeah?
It was exciting. There were funny letters.
Almost slates coming in? Who delivered them?
Yeah, it was really wild. I think there's some things that were unbelievably wild. Give me a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, Keith, tell us a little about your sort of Robin Ray connectivity.
I'm Diana. Thank you, first off, thank all of you for having me here, and thank you for sharing Ray, particularly with us, all those years. I'm on the wrong side. I should be. Hello. You think I'd know how to use one of these right now? I'm sitting on the wrong side of the table. I mean, I'm honored to be on this side of the table, but really is like just any one of you getting to sit up here with these fine people. I was a fan as a kid of the WOR show. My father had brought home the album from the Broadway show, and I had enjoyed it very much. But for some reason, one day I got hooked in on Mary Backstage. And I came back and listened the next day, and then the next thing I knew, I was rescheduling classes to make sure I'd be home in time to start when the show was 10 after 3, after as soon as the news was under 12 after 3, whatever it was. I started to write fan letters, and by that time, Bob had taken over the Secretary of News, I guess. And he, any of you had this experience, every letter I wrote, I got a letter back, which I still have, and they have this spectacular stationery that listed as the board of directors, 70 or so, gosh, how many characters? Well, the top 70 on the side were listed. All of your favorites were listed as characters. And one day, my father heard there was a bank opening they were going to appear at, and we went into the city. And my father, being my father, as soon as it was done, pushed away everybody and went up to both Bob and Ray and said, "This is the young man who writes your papers on up to New York." And I'm shrinking as I just hoping to get out of their view. You just don't, actually address the deities in your life in that way. And they were gracious and wonderful. And my father immediately then pounced on this opportunity that they gave him by saying, "Hey, how about we come in and watch the show sometime?" Which they again graciously said, "Sure, probably this whatever week would be." And for later that was, it was 6 or 8 weeks, I don't know that I got a full night's sleep on any of those occasions. And I came in on the appointed day in 1974 in May and watched this. And then he said, "Come in a little early. You can see the preparation," because it was my intent to go into broadcasting. So I was there for an hour and a half before the show went on the air and an hour and a half into it. And if my father had not finally said, "We should let them get to work. Let's get out of here." It's like, I'm going to stay there until they turn the lights off in the studio. But the experience of watching it, the experience of listening to it is, as you know, transcendent. You are taken inside that world, and it is a world, and it has laws, and it has rules, and that's the whole comedic structure on which everything hangs. That joy of listening to them trying to crack each other up, which they confessed even to me when I was a 15-year-old kid trying to, get a few answers for a newspaper article for the school paper. But to watch it done, to watch we heard a little Mary Backstage, and from about that time, I'll tell you, the entire preparation was more or less like this. Well, we got them in the captain, in the whaling ship with the Captain Morgan. Okay, so Bob says, "Let's bring them back to port today at Mystic Seaport." And Ray was just, "No, you can't bring them back today. It's Friday. We'll bring them back Monday." To maintain the cliffhanger from radio on which they were raised. Again, there was a series of laws, and the thing that helped makes it hold together still was that there was nothing that any one of their characters ever did that was out of character. They stayed with it entirely, and as much as they were trying to make people laugh, they never let that on, never let you know that this was supposed to be funny. All these ridiculous characters were serious as all heck, and that was most of the humor was based on that. The guy who's the ketchup executive who's figured out a way to sell more ketchup, which is just changed flavor to chocolate. And it's Ray doing this very earnest voice of it. "Well, not ketchup as you civilians know now,
And Bob very gently lets him down and says, well, so what you're saying is you're having National Ketchup Week to sell chocolate sauce. There's a long pause, and he goes, you know, when you put it that way, it doesn't sound like that good an idea. And it was my idea, so I better get back to the office. And then the door, you know, the sound effect of the door slamming and the theme for Widen Your Horizons plays. But I'll shut up and let the family talk again. You made the mistake of letting me hear, so you're going to get this. To watch Mary Backstage in particular, which was the ad lib of ad libs, I was 15 and I saw this and I said, I will never see anything this creative again in my life. I have not found anything close to it. There are a couple of things here and there that have popped up that are reminiscent. This is what it was. It was, no, you can't have them come back today. We have to leave that for the cliffhanger. Just have the captain get hit a couple of times in the head with the beam and change personality two or three times, and we'll threaten him and we'll just go from there. Okay? And Bob went, all right. And then Ray just said, are you ready? And everybody cleared their throats for about 6 seconds. And my father cleared his throat, and I cleared my throat, and I just was sitting in the corner, literally back there in the equivalent of this room. And he just, I guess Ray did the cue and just said, all right, let's go. Play the theme. And they sat there and ad-libbed in 6 different voices each. To each other, to themselves, advancing a plot, and also periodically sending a series of hand signals that their producer, Bob Kiley, at that point, knew exactly what it was. Cues for sound effects, which I only heard in the finished product. But this was pre-taped ad-libbed in case, I suppose, something disastrous happened. The other thing was, it was supposed to be 3.5 minutes. I was watching the clock. It finished at 3:32, 3:32. Ad-lib. Most people given a 3.5 minute script can't get it done in 3.5 minutes. This is ad-lib with cues and everything else, and they wrapped it up with some sort of punchline at which there was a sidearm cue from Bob to indicate play the theme. So the episode ends, Bob throws the sort of sidearm cue, the theme plays again, and Bob jumps into his announcer voice, summarizes the episode. And so our friends, and blah, 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 and I'm thinking, none of this is prepared at all. They've just done a comedic bit that has advanced a story using different characters, talking to each other, and always following the rules of the script, dropping in some phrase that seems funny. They go off on tangents like rack and pinion steering, which was a big thing in car advertising. And every once in a while you hear Calvin Hoogan and go, what is rack and pinion steering? I lay awake at night wondering what is rack and pinion steering. And then it goes right back to the plot. For some, and I found out later, some of the stuff would be references to disputes with management, which I found out much later to my joy, because that's what half of my stuff on ESPN was, disputes with management. It was a great way to vent. And then finally, as Bob is wrapping up the episode, he'd simply turn and say, tune in Monday when we'll hear, pick one of Ray's voices, whichever it might be appropriate or perhaps totally inappropriate to this bit. Tune in when we'll hear, could have said, we'll hear Mary say, Calvin, or Greg Marlowe, or, you know, tune in Monday when back in New York we'll hear Greg Marlowe say, and Greg Marlowe had nothing to do with the episodes for the previous 2 weeks. It was essentially throwing a punch at him. Let's see what you can do with this. Tune in Monday when we'll hear Calvin say, and Calvin had to say something. Ray had to do this in Calvin's voice. It had to be 2 or 3 seconds, wrap up the episode, be the absolute funniest joke, and advance the story. It had to be something they would then follow as the script for the next show. And that was it. And then it would be, and that's Monday, and the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage, Noble Wife, Word Car Speaking. Theme hits, and they're done at 3:32. And I sat back and went, maybe I'll become a priest. And Ray literally said at that point, I think that was all right. Never seen anything like it. And one other story that this is a good time to put in, because this is brand new Bob and Ray research information. Literally, I found this out last week. My next I'm not necessarily going to call it an advancement, but the next group that I became fanatic about was Monty Python's Flying Circus. It doesn't seem like there's any connection here, and I never found one, and I thought this is just, you know, good humor. Quality material and well thought out on just the same qualities in both groups, even though they couldn't be more different. I found out something a week ago Thursday. I had Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones and John Cleese on my show. And I mentioned, because they started to talk about how what their fans didn't know was that they principally did what they did to make the other guy laugh. And I said, this is the second time I heard this. Ray Goulding said this to me in 1974, and I didn't see great recognition from John Cleese or from Terry Jones, but something in Terry Gilliam's eyes lit up. And afterwards, we were having a quick bite to eat, and Terry Gilliam said, I'm so glad you mentioned Bob and Ray. And I went, what? He said, well, two of my heroes, my absolute heroes, because I was an illustrator when I was a kid, and I was a Mad Magazine guy, and I worked for Mad Magazine in the 60s, and I used to see the Mad Magazine bits that they did that were done as illustrations. It's that not only did I hear them, but I appreciated them from a visual sense when nobody else had a visual sense, and that informed much of my humor, and what I ever brought to Monty Python was largely an extension of Bob and Ray. So now, I mean, this is like talking about DNA from different sources, Brian. There's a part, at least some of Monty Python owes itself directly to the fact that one of the six members was an American Bob and Ray fan from Minnesota. So that's new, and I had never heard that before, and I think that explains an awful lot about their success as well.
You mentioned the, being on the ship or whatever, and it was probably Wolf Larson was the guy. Yeah. And, Wolf Larson, another one of my favorite characters.
Keep a tongue in your head, Petey.
He would go from this sweetheart, borderline sweetheart guy, and of course something, he gets slammed in the head, hit by a beam, and then immediately be, why you? And then you'd hear punching and crashing, and it was just, I just love that sort of Sea Wolf, Jekyll and Hyde thing that went on. I want to do this little, if I can figure this thing out, little Keith Olbermann and Bob and Ray moment, if I know how to use this thing. No, I don't.
I am Tippy the Wonder Dog.
All these balance. Yes, sir. But, maybe. Let me try this, then try that. And what do you know?
Olbermann wrote to us to fill us in on that. Remember that fellow called us on the phone yesterday asking us about the unassisted triple plays, and he has a complete list of all of them. The last one was made, unassisted double play. It was made in 1968 by Ron Hanson, who was a shortstop for the Washington Senators at that time, versus the Cleveland Indians. So there.
He can cut those.
Oh, he has
statistics right at his fingertips. Anybody? He's a great baseball card collector. This fellow from Hanson's on Hudson, and they had a big meeting of all of baseball gum card collectors a couple of weeks ago, which he attended. And they buy and they sell them. They go up into the hundreds, some of the rare ones. And we were on one.
Yeah.
We did radio people 20 years ago, I guess. We were on one somewhere, someplace. I don't have one, do you?
Bowman's gum. No, I don't have one. I do wish I'd kept my baseball cards, though.
Oh,
I wouldn't give to have my Jimmy Fox right now.
Yeah. And all the Red Sox.
Doc Kramer and all the Red Sox.
Oh, if you come across.
All right, so Keith Olbermann also influenced Bob and Ray. So let's make sure we have that straight here.
Let's be correct about this, man. For 30 seconds in 1974.
By the way, are there any more triple plays since that's unassisted, since that stat?
Yeah.
Baseball moment?
Yeah, there was one earlier this season, in fact.
Yeah.
But what's really good about this is that Brian told me he had this and wanted to play this. And he said, but for some reason, my father only mentioned your last name. I said, no. You don't understand how that works. I recorded that off WOR in 1974, and I did not get to the play and record button fast enough. As you heard, even there, they didn't even let on I was a kid. There was on a personal level, for the fans, the respect these gentlemen had for us, I've never seen match. I've tried to keep some of it going myself. But as I said, any letter I wrote was always answered. Any reference was always, I saw Bob last year at the Museum of Broadcasting. It was as if I was doing him a favor by being there. think that says everything about who they were as people and their relationship to us.
There was this Julia Child sort of person called Mary Magoon. And as a kid, I remember them talking about Mary Magoon's recipe for, I think it was frozen ginger ale salad. But on the drive here from Long Island, my mother mentioned some event around the lighting of the Christmas tree. Would you share that with us?
Well, I was just mentioning, I remember NBC was having their show down on the ice rink, and that they were going to light the tree, and Bob and Ray were supposed to be on ice skates. Well, neither one of them had been on skates for ages, and they're kind of holding on to each other. Plus, Ray's and Mary Magoon, big, doughy skirt, trying to stand up on this ice rink. And it really ended up being a fiasco almost because they had trouble standing up. But it was quite a memory to see them trying to skate and do their skits. I also might add that, you know, being home and listening to my husband and his partner having so much fun, and I'm home with six kids, did you realize that?
My mother actually was having more fun than they were. She just doesn't want to say. We were really a joy to raise. I have very clear memories of that. Really.
I remember one time.
Yeah,
that,
grab the mic, Ann.
I remember one time that was a Linda Lovely bit, and there was a knock on the door opened, and Linda screamed.
Microphone.
And then the next morning in the office, Bob saying, "I wonder where we're going with him." So that night it started out with, "Do the Wilsons live here?" And that was it. It was just a
all these characters and these voices, while they lived in Bob and Ray land, they also lived in our house, not as a character necessarily, but in different goofy ways. And I was told, and I have faint memories of this fake guy who used to come home when I was a little baby, or young enough to be in my room with one of those little gates where you can't escape from your room. And it was a guy named Frank. And this guy, Frank, was probably like Wolf Larson. And he'd come in like, "Where's your dad?" This guy wanted to beat up my father. I never could see him. I heard him. And I'm sure I was petrified, but Where is he? Is that accurate?
Right. And you thought he came in a station wagon.
I did?
Whenever you saw a station wagon, you thought that where that voice was going to come from.
So this inventive creativity, here's a little anecdote. My dad, if you make pancakes from the pre-made box where you add milk and eggs or not eggs, I remember my dad made a little derivation of the recipe. If it called for half a cup of milk, he did a quarter cup of milk and a quarter cup of seltzer, which actually made him really sort of more airy. There was one time where my nephew, I don't know how little he was, but he was there, and my dad was making breakfast. He's making pancakes for him. And he has him convinced that these things are so light and airy, you have to hold them down while you eat them, otherwise they're just going to... So my nephew, Bry, is eating pancakes with his thumb on the pancake so he don't come up off the plate. When I was reading some history about Bob and Ray to just be able to contribute in some fashion about the past. And when they first came to New York, from what I read, it sounded like they just were working morning shows, afternoon shows. There was a 15-minute television program at some point in time, and I think he was 29 years old, and my older brother, Ray Jr., had these kinescopes, which I think is some old archaic film thing, and he converted them to VHS at the time. And he brought them for Christmas, and we're watching them, and we're just loving it. My dad was so embarrassed, because he sees this raw, unprepared 29-year-old, and now he's, I guess, you know, a more refined version of the 29-year-old self. He's actually sort of annoyed that we were seeing it in his less than wonderful state, and we thought it was the greatest. On this show, Audrey Meadows. I think Audrey Meadows' first TV event may have been on this 15-minute program. Audrey Meadows, of course, went on to be many things, and Jackie Gleason, Honeymooners especially. But I thought that was kind of a neat thing. But seeing them winging it, like you were describing, Keith, on radio, they're doing the same thing, only now it's on TV. And I remember my dad saying, and this is just like probably a common radio joke, that he had a wonderful face for radio. That's what he told me. So anyway, radio was their medium. That's where the mind and the games could be played and all the sound effects. I even think that, and I may not be completely accurate, that while Bob and my dad were throwing things back and forth like a great tennis match, I think the engineer now and again would throw a sound effect. Just to
toss them into another place and see how they can handle it. And nobody would know listening this, because they're never duped. They are just living, they were living in a different place where they both were just dancing around having a ball.
You know, when they first came to New York, as you say, they were Thursday morning night. They had a morning show, they had an evening show, and on Saturday night they had an hour show. And they used to go, the Today Show had just started working out of a studio at the theater there across from NBC. And they would bring the Bob and Ray Show down over there for a little bit of their morning show. Every day they showed up on the Today Show outside the window.
Oh, really?
An interview, wasn't it? It was
right.
One of
right,
the man
right,
on the street.
Right.
I think this executive is still at NBC because of the way Bob told me the story was they would do the interview,
right,
and one day the guy, whoever was in charge, I don't think it was Pat Weaver, I think it was somebody else, said, "Doesn't that fella know he's interviewing the same man on the street every day?" He runs NBC News now. Thank you.
Well,
you
know,
we're going to go on and not stop, but I want to take a moment now. If anybody out in the audience wants to share some Bob and Ray things, please don't. No, just kidding. Yes, sir.
I thought it was real.
Yeah.
But what was the origin of the phrase, "Why did we get working? Hang by your thumb. Why did we get that line?"
I truthfully haven't the slightest idea.
I will guess that they made it up on the spot one time and then it stuck like glue. That's my best guess anyway.
The resident historian here, I can confirm that at least that was Mr. Elliott's story. They had to sign off. They had extra time to sign off one night. Rather than just saying good night or good afternoon, I guess it's still in Boston.
Yeah,
and they
right,
just filled time with it. And it suddenly became as everything else. Where are we
right,
going from this? Well,
yeah,
we guess we'll have to do this again tomorrow. 46 years.
Yeah.
I just thought of something that I know I'll forget. I remember hearing this thing in some old album, and there was a Red Sox outfielder whose name was Bob Elliott. And there was this one bit. Boston Braves, see? Third baseman? There was a baseball player in Boston whose name was Bob Elliott. We're going to get back on what he played. I don't know, but Bob Elliott is now broadcasting himself, pretending to be this guy. There's a fly ball that's coming to me. I'm back. And he falls over the wall like, I got it. Don't move me. I thought that was so cool. Yes, sir.
I was in Boston, and about 5 weeks ago, when I went up to visit Bob Elliott in Huntsville, Maine. And when he took that, it's a tremendous afternoon. We reminisced, going back to the news days. And I said to him, what sort of comedy scenes in history that hated each other, like Abbott and Sheldon hated each other, Mark and Rubin hated each other. I said, what type of impression do you think you can bring that to? That he loved each other, they were like brothers, there was never a cross word between them, all they knew was the other. The other thing I want to mention, Andy Tony and Hart's domain, these magnificent paintings, are just painted to the master. He was a master artist.
Yes, he's really a wonderful artist.
Actually, and he also, I spoke with Bob the other day, and he said to be sure and give his best regards, because he was sorry you couldn't be part of this.
Jerry, your hand's not up, but come on. The hands that are up, I will certainly recognize you, but.
Some of the few who probably had experienced in the Boston years, they used to allow people in the studio once in a while. It was a very small studio, and they had a piano and an organ in there. And I must have cut class or something, because it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that. And they stood it every day at night, and they had papers in front of them. And I assumed they were script writing about just script. So when they left, the program was over, they left the papers on the little stand there, but running up to claim them.
The network says you have to have them. So they did. They sit down with me. I was in it.
They didn't follow them. They haven't.
They sure did. If anyone said, yeah, they did. Remember that. They had Smelly Dave traveling around the country. And
I think Smelly Dave was a dead whale, is that right? Second tour.
Yes. And one day I had a package delivered to the office. And it was a Smelly Dave. It really was. I called the phone. I don't know where they were. Like, what are you doing? A dead whale. What do I do with this? I went home. Yes.
Oh, there was quite a bit. Yes. Oh, if it showed up on the boxcar there, people would show up at the station to see if it was going to come through, like they said.
Yeah. Oh,
that
was wild.
They also would. I know they would advertise things that didn't really exist. You know, ridiculous. I think I was reading this article that. I think they had offered ripped sheets, used ripped sheets for 15 cents.
Overstock warehouse
stuff.
Yeah.
And they got a dime and a nickel taped together.
These weren't first, they weren't second, they weren't third, maybe fourth.
People would mail in for them. The gentleman in the black had his hand up as well. Yes, sir?
I have the pleasure of telling my late mother-in-law chandelier to Bob Elliott's daughter-in-law.
Congratulations, you got a good price on eBay. What happened on eBay? And the gentleman next to the chandelier gentleman.
You were talking about Senator Clark there. Remember that
guy? Yeah.
Commissioner Clark? That's right. I think that you probably could shed
a
light on.
A little background. Those of you who were fans at that time of the McCarthy time know that Bob and Ray took on in a light but extremely efficient way Joe McCarthy. And they did it by doing something I wish I learned how to do, which is to subtract the politics from it and just do the humor. They turned him into, and Ray did, a dead-on Joe McCarthy. At least we were told this because there didn't seem to be a recording of it. This was in the 70s and 80s. It was a reminiscence. No, we didn't record it. Usual stuff. We don't have a copy of it. It's just a radio show. They turned him into a building commissioner who was ruling on whether or not it was okay for the backstages to build a 70-story house in Skunk Haven, Long Island. ancestral home of the backstage family. And this had been sort of legendary because they... You know, it really was, at that point, it was Edward R. Murrow and Bob and Ray who were willing to make fun of Joe McCarthy, and pretty much everybody else just hoped it would go away. Years later, in fact, after Ray died, I was living in Los Angeles doing sports on the local news, and Charles Champlin, who was the arts editor of the LA Times, who was a very good writer and a real expert in the field, wrote a very loving tribute to Ray. It really was wonderful, but for Charlie, it was very poorly written, and you could tell he was broken up. I mean, he was writing in pain, and I thought, well, okay, I don't know this man, but as a fellow fan, I should send him a tape, a copy of my tape of the stuff I used to record off WOR, because there's nothing that's going to cheer him up better than that. I get a phone call from him in a couple of days, and he said, you recorded them when you were a kid? I said, yes. He said, I recorded them when I was a student at Columbia in 1954. I bought a record player that allowed you to record. It was horrifically expensive, and the first, you know, maybe they sold 100 of them, but I had one, and I would record them on WINS in the mornings. And I'm thinking, okay, when were you there? He said, I was there in 53 and 54 and 55. And I said, you know, the sort of the holy grail of Bob and Ray collectors were the Commissioner Carstairs episodes, where... But yeah, where Ray has Ray does his perfect imitation of Joe McCarthy. I said, yeah. He said, yeah, I have him in the garage.
Excuse me? He had those by happenstance. When you hear them on the collection, the radio art collection, those are Charlie Champlin's, which he recorded because he said it was just too good to let it go out into the ether and not be preserved in some way, which was my logic in 1973 and 1974 for recording a lot of stuff that wound up on these cassettes, which turns out to have been the priest in Boston in the late 40s who recorded a lot of the WHDH shows, because over the generations, when I first saw the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I said, I know this emotion here, because we have to do something about this. We have to preserve this. The guy in 1949, a priest in 1949, a college student in 1954, a couple of other people in the CBS days in the late 50s, and a kid who wanted to go into broadcasting in suburban New York in 1974, recorded for some unknown posterity because it was just too good. It was just also, the other trick was you wanted to hear it again yourself and get the first set of jokes you missed while laughing at the original one. But to tie it off with Commissioner Carstairs, Bob told me that he went to Havana in the late 50s. You want to tell this story? Or does
it's
more of a vignette. It's more of a picture because there wasn't an actual real exchange. But maybe weeks before it became impossible to get to and from Cuba, is that about right?
Right.
The families went to Havana, and there's nobody on the plane. It's just like there's a plane, and it's just Elliot and Goulding, and that's it. And at the last moment, they're holding this empty flight, and a figure comes bounding onto the plane, and it's Roy Cohn.
It's
McCarthy's investigator and, general henchman. And he says, there's nobody on the plane, and he finds the seat that's the furthest away from them because he knew every second of Commissioner Carstairs. So the idea that, Bob was very proud of the thing. He had this magazine tucked into his jacket, Secrets or whatever, Confidential.
Right.
One of these bribery magazines. If you don't pay, we write an article about you. And this is 1959, 1960. The idea that it's just humor and Edward R. Murrow took down McCarthy and the serious media, but no. Roy Cohn remembered that somebody made fun of Joe McCarthy and the ridiculousness of him with the politics subtracted, remembered that it was done. And I always thought they didn't get the credit they deserved for being part of that process. So there's a huge story in there. Forgive me for taking so long.
Yes, sir.
They were at WHDH. And they made this record, and it'll be a, and what was the other card? Cow in Switzerland. And they said, send in for it, and a dollar, I think it was, for the record. And they used to say they would go to the box office and get all these dollar bills coming to them, and they'd look over their shoulder walking back to HDH because they were afraid they were going to be robbed.
Yeah.
But that was great. Then I had it converted to a tape, and I listened to it not too long ago. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
I
want to go home
in Switzerland
where the
stars are always blue. I just happen to have it on my iPhone.
Oh, no.
If you ever see Keith working out on a treadmill or something, he's got the headphones, you know what he's listening to.
Did I mention I was a fan?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah, the folks who were the Mary backstage, or Mary, I don't remember, Mary Noble
if
backstage.
No, there wasn't any contact that I know of.
No, this is one of these things. These people will never know. I hope they did.
I don't know. It's a good question. No, evidently, there wasn't any official contact, like, thanks for goofing on us. Right? Do you know of anybody?
Not as far as I know.
There was one TV show that they thought it was going to be the last. They had decided it was like Linda Lovely or whatever. So they killed them all off. And then the upstairs.
I don't know that I can say something about it. I might even have one, but that's just, you know, the twisting of something in real life into something ridiculous. I forget what was the real name of that show?
Lost Persons.
Right.
Yeah, Mr. Keene, Trace of Lost Persons, and this is Mr. Trace, keener than most people.
But after they killed him off, his wheel said, no, don't kill them off. So all they saw then was the next day, watching them in the hospital through all the different Tallulah called in and said that was the funniest show she'd ever seen in her life.
The gentleman in the red tie.
Question. I know there's a family connection with Raymond Knight, the writer's performer from the
30s,
and I'm wondering if his work influenced Bob
and
Ray
and the comedy. I'm pretty sure. Did he do some writing for them at some point?
Yeah,
right?
Actually, yes.
But Ray told him, he says, I used to listen to you when I was a little kid. It didn't fit too well.
So does that answer your question? Yeah? Yes, sir. Right here. Yes, that is that's a classic because he had the other organization, the FDMA.
Yeah, the FDMA.
Actually, I think, well, I am those Gary Estevan. The priest that you mentioned earlier, and do some of their skits word for word.
Oh, just wonderful.
Yes, sir, in the hat over there. Him, he said he took his shirt off, could have been Bob, and one of them sort of, I think he just took his shirt off and swam by the window, you know, while the guy is trying to maybe do the news.
Yeah, on the table, and the other one pushing the table, and
oh, yeah.
Poor Peter Roberts.
Oh, Peter Roberts.
He used to laugh like the, and then he went, well, he went that morning, because I was there.
Yeah, that's
good. That was funny.
That was, where we were seated in that tour, that seated tour in 1974, my father and I were seated at a table next to the newscaster's table, essentially in the corner, and it was Roger Skibinis. And I actually asked him, what's this like? Because I noticed, having little radio experience in high school at that point, I noticed he seemed to be looking up a lot.
like just down to the corner of his eye every once in a while, and I just was like, "Were you expecting a bulletin?" He said, "No, that's not what I was expecting." "What? I don't understand, Mr. Skibinis. What do you mean?" He said, "Well, every once in a while, they have an opinion on how I'm doing the news." They try to interrupt me or make me laugh. "Have nice to meet you." And I thought, well, that's a pretty good reason to keep the eye going over here.
Yeah.
You just never knew, apparently.
My sister Melissa wanted to say something. Yes, Ben, what?
Well, I'm just going to mention one time I was buying a print in a gallery on the gate, and the woman behind the counter that was doing a sale said, "Oh, you know, I see you in my name," and he goes, "Oh, you related to Bob Ray?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I'm their daughter." And I'm like, "I'm your daughter." I mean, I'm Ray's daughter. And she said, she started laughing. And then she said, "I have to tell you that she lived outside of Boston." And she said she and her husband were standing at the end of their yard with binoculars trying to see the Boston Marathon run backwards. She said they absolutely believed that was happening.
They had a fan that used to write to them, and she was on the same network. And oh, she was wild, and she was married to them.
Oh my!
So she called one day, and I said, "What is it?" And finally, I said, "I'm Ray's wife." Oh. So then the next letter was, "What happened to your stockhead wife?" "She's the one in the office is redhead." Oh, it was wild, but she was married to them.
Wow.
Yeah, she was wild.
I had a question actually for the guy in the black, like the chandelier. And what do you think that thing is worth? I'm sitting here, I'm looking at it. Right. Anybody else in the audience want to throw? Yes, sir. Right here in front. I'll speak for me. When I was a kid, I wanted to be. I thought my dad and Bob had a cool job. I actually thought Johnny Carson had even a cooler job, sitting there having a ball, making fun of people, but having a nice time. No one has really pursued it necessarily. One thing about growing up in my house, I think we all developed a sense of humor as sort of a survival thing. If you need something passed to the table, you know, you better be ready for it. It comes with words. So I really think it was more of a self-defense. It's now just sort of a cellular thing, and we have fun. But we haven't pursued it yet. I might tomorrow, though. Tonight I'm going to sleep on this. It's a really good idea.
Well, I like didn't really get to know my grandfather that much, but like I think when I was about 10 or 11, I found his CDs, the Golden Theater performance in the Carnegie Hall. I used to listen to them all the time, and I think, well, my personal favorite was the banister sliding contest. Every single time I hear someone slide down that banister and just, you know, crash into something else, or feel like, you know, things breaking, I lost it. And it was, I think for me it was really cool because I didn't get to know my grandfather that well, personally, or, you know, when he was living, but after listening to his tapes, it was cool to kind of get that sort of experience of knowing, like, what my grandfather did and, you know, who he was. And it's cool because I got to have that experience when, you know, a lot of other people don't really get to know their grandparents if they've passed away before they're really old enough. So I think, you know, my personal experience is just, I really enjoyed listening to him and just, you know, getting to hear my grandfather. So that's my question.
This is a strange tangent, but I remember, go ahead, I'm sorry. When he was going through listening, he listened to so much Bob and Ray, I was having really mixed emotions, but I just, like, turned that off. And my father wasn't around, and I felt like I'm in serious trouble when I get to heaven. If I get to heaven, he's not going to be too happy, and I'm telling my son Rory to turn off my dad. Enough already. Yes? They don't speak. They're mute.
Sarah there. Actually, I don't know who two of these people are.
Well, I was just going to say, like, I have a similar experience to Rory here. And, like, I don't know if you remember this, but there was, like, a summer where Rory and I decided to play Bob and Ray. And we would just, remember we'd, like, sit in the studio and, like, fight about who could be Grant.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, like, Kimono Dragon and, like, just act out all the different skits. And, like, that's really when I first kind of, like, realized who my grandfather was. And another thing I want to say is I just graduated from college, and so, yay. And, you know, people in my generation, I don't really talk about it because it's, but you'd be surprised how many people even my age know who they are and then still think it's funny, which I love because it's wholesome humor and there's, anyone can enjoy it. And I think that's the part of it that's so, like, magical for me is it's just, forever is so funny because it's never outdated. I love it.
Sorry, we have 60 seconds and counting. Virginia, you want to say something?
I got to know Ray as my boyfriend's father. And before that, before I got to know my husband, who was my boyfriend, I guess it was about 5 years before I met Bryant. I was very sick with bronchitis, and my mother was concerned because I never really got sick. So she went and got me a Bob and Ray book, right as you get work.
Before we met.
And so my mother thought it was really important when I wasn't feeling well. Laughter is the best medicine. So years later, I met Bry, and then I got to meet his dad and his mom and his whole family. And Ray was very giddy when I told him about the book that I still have that helped me get better. And he was always a really generous person to me, and I just felt like I got to know the other Ray, the Ray that was really great with kids, that knew how to quiet a crying baby, who if I said I loved the cheese that he was serving, he would go out and get me a big wheel of it. Who was shy at parties, who he and my grandfather thought that he and Bob were two guys that talked on the radio. He didn't really know that they were funny, but he just thought they talked on the radio. So when my grandfather and Ray would sit in our backyard and talk about baseball, I thought, wow, this is great, because my grandfather knows Ray as a really nice, kind person. He's not the celebrity. He's Ray Goulding sitting in the backyard talking about baseball. So so I was really blessed that I got to meet Ray Goulding as Ray Goulding, my father-in-law.
Evidently, that's it. We want to say, all right, you know what? You had your arm up. That was a good arm lift. One more shot, even though we don't count. Yes, sir.
Gentlemen, in the audience. Yeah. Three times with Bob and Ray. I missed a lot of Bob and Ray on radio because I'm not on radio. That's getting a little bit of a story in my head. The first time I heard it, WOR, they announced the name of Mr. Albert. And they kept bringing up the announcement. Nobody knew what they were doing. But I remember it saying, in a small set of it, it was not the end. He said, oh, you shouldn't. Oh, you mustn't. What the heck they were doing. Burning the script, that's been done by other people as well. I guess they were just too wonderful. The second number in the fourth, why you? I remember saying it sounds like a terrible fight. I love that. The third number is Mary McGoon on television. Apparently, it was live on television because this was a bottle that couldn't be corrected because it all had already happened. Mary Mazum was shown from the waist down, and she was taking a pie in the shape of an octopus. The pie. And Mary Mazum said, oh, and these are the testicles.
I'm
we'll talk about octopus anatomy as well here today.
That was the end of that show that particular night. It was going off, and they used to then go back and Claude Elliott, Light Network, you know, Hangman or something, all that. Ray said, he closed it.
I want to say thank you to my family for being here. Thank you so much for Keith Urban for spending the afternoon here with us. And thank you all for enjoying Bob and Ray and today. Thank you.
I might as well mention that was Arthur Anderson, our very own Arthur Anderson, who was making that last comment. This is Mike Beal. I'm at the 34th annual Friends of Old Time Radio Convention, and we've just been loving a panel with the family of Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding, with the main person emceeing it being Ray Goulding's son, and sitting next to him, Keith Olbermann, who